Well, good morning again. If you want to grab a Bible, we're going to be in John chapter 20. I'll have the words on the screen as well, and there are Bibles in the pew if you'd like to do that. We'll get there in just a moment, but again, I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Joe Graham. I'm one of the pastors with the Harbor Churches, and if you didn't know this, Harbor Life is part of a multi-site church, and we share the mission of helping people find their way back to God. We have five different places where we meet on Sunday mornings. And Pastor Tanner Smith, who is the pastor at this church, is currently in Hungary with his wife, Kristen. He's going to be he's been there this week, and he's going to be gone next week. He's there to connect with one of our global mission partners. We have missionary partners all over the world, and we send our people to go and connect with them. And so if you could pray for Tanner and Kristen as they travel, they're going to get to see a few parts of Europe, too, after they're with our missionary partners, which is a great gift to them as a couple. But leaving the country, being apart from your family, brings a lot of logistics. So if you could pray traveling mercies over them as they travel. So today we're going to can take another step into our sermon series that began on Good Friday and Easter. It's called Defining Moments. In this series, we've been talking about the big moments in our lives that define us and how these things start to shape us. We've been using two Greek words for time. I'm going to assume that you guys have done that. Have you heard these two words, chronos? And then everywhere, everyone says it a little bit different. Kairos or kairos? Or have you heard both? Kairos? Ros? 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 We're going to go with Ros. So I'll probably say Ros because I said Ros. I took a lot of Greek in seminary, and I still wasn't clear on how the O's were said because I heard different people. So we're going to go Kairos moments, all right? So these moments where Chronos moments is the chronological, the tick-tock, this happens and that happens, kind of the linear way that we view life. And then Kairos moments are these bigger things that happen where we have to stop and go, what is God doing in this moment? How do we interpret and make sense of what this moment means for us? Because we know that defining moments come to us in a variety of different ways. You know, some come with great pain and difficulty and fear and confusion. And then some are really good and they come with great moment of clarity, a great moment of understanding, newness, healing, and meaning. And so to put handles on these defining moments, we've been looking at the 40 days after the resurrection of Jesus and the different encounters his disciples and different people had with Jesus as they tried to make sense of what it meant that the resurrection was real. You see, the most defining moment in all of history, we believe, is the death and resurrection of Jesus. It changed everything. It changed everything for the history of the world, for the history of you, and for the history of me. And today, we're going to look at one encounter that happens between Jesus and his disciples, and one disciple in particular who has a kairos moment. See, I'm going to do it. It's going to go back and forth the whole time. Has a kairos moment, and for better or worse, he's been defined by this moment and labeled for the rest of history since this moment. So we're going to be in John chapter 20, beginning with verse 24. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Now, for some reason, because the disciple Thomas said, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe," for the rest of history, he is known as who? Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas. The label stuck. The moment gave definition to Thomas. I mean, a week before, literally a couple verses before this one, Jesus came to the disciples in the same exact way. They were in a house, and the doors were locked, and he appeared to them. And this is the same Jesus who was killed on a cross and then rose again, and Thomas happened to not be there when he came, and he said, no way. No way. So we jump back to verse 19 in the same chapter. It says, on the evening of the first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. So this incident basically happens twice, and Thomas missed the first one. After he said this, he showed them his hands and the side, the same thing that Thomas wanted to see. And the disciples were overjoyed with the Lord in that moment. They were overjoyed, and they had their Kairos moment. They had that moment where they came to this new understanding that the resurrection of Jesus was real. This really happened. And Thomas wasn't there. And for the rest of history, we know him as Doubting Thomas. I looked into the word doubting and believing. The Greek word there is actually the same word. There's just a negative particle. So it makes it from being believing to unbelieving. But for some reason, we translate it as doubting, right? Feels a little bit different. It's like, you know that one thing you did when you were 13 years old? And your family always brings it up whenever you're together as a larger family. You know, it's like when my mom says I'm stubborn, that boils my blood, because it's true, right? And, you know, it's that one thing, and whenever we get together, for better or for worse, we bring up that one thing that you did that one time in a moment of who knows what. You can't even remember why you were mad, and, you know, you jumped on your brother's back, and you sunk your teeth right into their shoulder, right? It's that one moment, and it becomes this thing that sticks upon you. I mean, why can't Thomas be recognized and remembered for some other things that he said? I mean, when he says, my Lord and my God, like, this is a really big deal. He makes the enormous connection about who Jesus is. He crosses this line of faith and says, my Lord and my God. And he sees that all the things that Jesus said and did are now true and that the resurrection is real. But because he doubted, because he wasn't there, we remember him as Doubting Thomas. Or what about this? There's another story where Thomas says what I would argue is a better line. From John chapter 11. After he said this, he went on to tell them, this is Jesus speaking, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. You see, their friend Lazarus had died. So then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him. Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, the same disciple, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. So their friend Lazarus had died. And there was this some confusion because Jesus didn't seem to be worried about it. And there was this Kairos moment happening on the journey to Lazarus. And Thomas is the very one who says, let us go so that we may die with him. That's how he's interpreting what Jesus is telling them. I would rather be remembered for the line that says, let us also go that we may die with him. It's like this fearless Thomas. It's like this guy who doesn't even question Jesus. He says, I don't know if Lazarus is dead or alive, but you're going to do something amazing, and I'm going to go wherever you're going to go, and I will die with you. Why isn't Thomas remembered for that line? Because he's Doubting Thomas, right? And he did that one thing that one time. So the truth is, I think we are like Thomas. It's easy to let a single moment define us and set the course for the rest of our lives. It's easy for that one comment that one coach or teacher said to stick on us. A friend of mine said this week, he said, I played baseball, and one year I made the All-Star team. And somewhere in that season, my coach told me I had a good eye. He goes, I don't know how I made the All-Star team, but for some reason, I made the team that year because that coach gave him that one little comment that gave him this boost of confidence, and he had a good eye, and he became a good hitter. So someone can say something, and it can stick. Or we can do something. We can make a mistake, And then we keep coming back to that mistake time and time and time again. And we let that define who we are. The labels are sticky. They get stuck on us and we can't get stuck. We can't get unstuck. So what moments define you? What labels have been stuck upon you? I mean, some of them are good, right? When you stand and you make vows and you get married, that's a moment that sticks. My favorite things to do as a pastor is you get to stand in this moment with people as they make vows that will change everything. And it's this amazing, incredible space. The first time you hold your child, it's a moment. You can remember what the whole room felt like. Or there's that mistake, right? There's that failure. That's disappointment. Someone says something to you, and it just burns. And it creates this reality that you start to believe in, and you rattle around in your head. Is this true? Is this not true? Is this really who I am? And we always seem to come back to the one moment or the one phrase or the one comment. And sometimes we live down to the low moment, and we live up to the high moment, and we get stuck. And I think we know that no one moment has the power to define us, that no one moment actually has the power to define who we are. But for some reason, Thomas will always be known as a doubter. I will always be a little bit stubborn. Or you will always be the little brother or the little sister who did that. Or you will always be the middle, or you will always be the first. Birth order has a thing in a way about how we get defined as people. It's like something will happen on a whiteboard. If you draw on a whiteboard and if you erase it pretty quickly, it goes away and you can't see it, right? So you could put a label or a phrase or a drawing up on a whiteboard. But if you leave it up there a little bit and then you come back the next day or maybe the next week because you forgot about it and you try to erase it, you erase it and the residue is still there, right? Like in order to get the marker off, you have to go find some cleaner or water. But like that's kind of how these moments are. Like it's like something that happens on a whiteboard and then we quickly erase it and it's white again. But sometimes it sticks and you can't get the residue off and it lingers and it rattles around in our head. So personality assessments, they're everywhere right now. I would make the argument that the modern workplace and the modern marriage and the modern relationship is defined by what your strengths are, what quadrant on the grid you are, what your number on the Enneagram is, what animal you are, what color you are. There's all these different tests. Has anybody done a personality assessment within the last year? The modern workplace seems to be defined by this, and there's a lot of help in them. They give you a greater sense of who you are. My wife and I have been engaging in the strengths quest right now, where they give you your top five strengths, and these are qualities that are your natural wiring, how you naturally perceive the world, how you naturally like to work as an individual or on our team. And a while back, I was having a Kairos moment with one of my strengths, and I was talking to my wife about it, and it went like this. I can remember where I was sitting when I said this. I can remember what it felt like. It became this great moment. You see, one of my top strengths is achiever. Any other achievers? If you've done the strengths in the room, any other achievers? I like to accomplish things. No joy is greater to me than making a list and then crossing something off the list. Can anyone identify with that, right? There's no joy that's greater to me than that, right? I trained for my first ever half marathon last year, and I don't like running. I don't like running, but I needed something. A friend of mine was like, we need something to get us going. And so I made a grid with every single run that I needed to do on the training plan and every single day that I would do that, just so that I would get myself out of bed because I knew I could cross the box off, right? And that would get me going. It was like a psychological trick, and that's where these strengths can become really helpful. And it makes us a little bit messed up, right? Because I go into every Saturday with what are 3 to 5 chores that I can get done, right? And I'll write it down on the counter because that's how I'm wired. And so I was talking to Tiff about this, and I read her the entire description of the achiever, which is like 2 paragraphs, right? That's kind of the crazy. I have to read the whole thing. And I start to describe, I'm like, this is why I like to get up really early and get as many things as I can done get done in the morning before anybody wakes up. This is why I do this, and this is why I do that. And she looks at me and she says, and this is why you're annoying to live with. Because my name is Joe, and I'm an achiever, and I like to get things done, but that can also make me annoying. Because sometimes I just need the Saturday and chill, right? Because while the label is true about me, it also is both grace and truth, right? It gives me this freedom to live into who I'm uniquely made to be. But there's also this truth that, like, if I live into that too much, I start to place value on how much I can get done, right? And that shouldn't fully define me. One of my good friends, she's a leadership coach and consultant, and she's certified and an expert in the Strengths Quest. And she talks about how we have these strengths that define who we are, and we either live in the basement with them or we live up on the balcony. And if we're in the balcony, we kind of see the whole picture. Like, we understand that, yeah, if I make that chart, it'll help me achieve that chart because I'm an achiever. And we kind of see how it fits into the larger puzzle of everything that is going on. But if we're in the basement, our vision is limited. And we're still motivated to be that way because it's how we are, but we can't see the whole picture, and we might actually run into others. So, like, no, I value that we do this way. I value that everyone gets along, and we're gonna run right into that. And it's gonna cause these tensions. So are we in the basement or are we in the balcony? Is Thomas really a doubter? Did that moment with Jesus really define him? Another story. My good friend Greg, who's the pastor at Fairhaven Church, another one of our churches, he told me a story this week about when he was in college. He was home, and he was doing a work project with his dad, and they were building something. And he almost worked himself into a heat stroke. He didn't take any water breaks. He didn't eat anything. He didn't sit down. He just kept going and going and going. And Greg was telling me the story. He's like, I had this moment where I had to figure out what was behind that. Well, when Greg was a little kid, one Saturday night, he heard his dad say to his mom, "Our kids are lazy." They had been doing some project around the house, and it was probably hard to get the kids around that project. It was a Saturday. And all Greg heard was his dad say, "Our kids are lazy." That could have been sarcastic. That could have been a subtle comment that didn't really mean that. It could have been just you guys were running around and I couldn't get you to help me pick up the yard, right? But because Greg was little, he heard that and he took meaning out of that and he took purpose and he took identity out of that. And if you've ever met Greg, lazy is the last word I would use to describe Greg. That guy would run through a wall for anyone. But because his dad said it, it stuck, right? Because when someone and your family says it, it sticks. And it sticks because words do have the power to create reality. Words and labels and moments, they matter. They give us identity and meaning. When Thomas says to Jesus, "My Lord and my God," he crosses this line of faith. And he believes in the resurrection. You see, if Jesus is alive, it means that it's all true. That we have been forgiven. That we are good enough. That Jesus is making all things new. That we are more than the moments and the labels that define us. And when Thomas says, "My Lord and my God," he makes this deeper connection. That he is not defined by who he is, rather he is defined by who Jesus is and what Jesus does. The Gospel of John is my personal favorite gospel because we have little things in here like this statement, "My Lord and my God," in the way that the writer constructed the whole gospel. You see, when Thomas uses his words to say that Jesus is Lord and that Jesus is God, something else is also being referenced. Because the writer wanted to make something really, really clear about who Jesus is in this gospel. If we go to John chapter 1, it begins like this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not overcome it. In this beginning of the Gospel of John, Jesus is who we ascribe as the Word. That's who we interpret him to be. And this John chapter 1 is an echo of Genesis chapter 1, the first book in the first chapter of the Bible. You see, in Genesis 1, God creates the world in this wonderful and miraculous way. And when God speaks, he creates reality. God says words, let there be light, and there is light. Let there be sky, and there is sky. Let there be stars, and there are stars. Let there be beasts that crawl along the earth. He speaks it, and it is so. And John 1 grabs onto that language and says, Jesus is the active creating power of God. Jesus is God's actual word. And then John later in verse 14 says, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. A new reality is created because God spoke it. He spoke the world into creation, and then he comes as his Son, full of grace and truth. And John is making this deeper connection, and when Thomas says, my Lord and my God, he confirms that the good news is real. Because this is the good news. The good news of the gospel is that God has come to us full of grace and truth. He died on the cross and he rose from the dead. And it means that the words and the moments that are stuck on us don't actually define us. They don't have the last word. Because in his death and his resurrection, God in the flesh, Jesus, took upon himself all that is wrong in the world, all of the sin, all of the shame, all of the brokenness, all of the moments, all of the labels, all of the things that don't make sense, and he redefined who we are and said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus doesn't define you by a single moment or a single label or something that makes you stuck. Rather, he meets you as the resurrected Lord and says, peace be with you. Put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hands and see the scar in my side. What most of us don't know about Thomas is that this is not where his story ends. Even though he's defined as the doubter for all of history, we have more history on him. I want to read this because there's some words I want to make sure I get right. A late tradition sees Thomas as having carried the gospel of Jesus to the Indian subcontinent. So India, modern-day India. First to the northwestern kingdom of Gandhaphoris. And then according to the 3rd century Acts of Thomas, a writing about Thomas, in the year 52, the apostle sailed in the company of a Jewish traveler named Abhinayas to the southern tip of India near present-day Patanam, which is in the Kerala state, one of the states in India. There was a Jewish community in India at that time, and upon his arrival, Thomas led 40 Jews to Jesus, along with 3,000 Hindu people. In his martyrdom, where he lost his life for his faith, actually happened not on the western coast of India, but all the way on the eastern coast. It's up near a city near Mylapore, where he came into some conflict with some Hindu priests because they thought he was assaulting their deities, and he was leading all these people to Jesus. He eventually lost his life, and then they took his body and they took it back to Mylapore. He was actually up the coast. They took it down to Mylapore and put his body in its final resting place at the church that he had founded there. They say the in about the 16th century, Portuguese explorers built St. Tome Basilica, and then in 1893, the British rebuilt it, and you can still go visit that today. So Thomas's story didn't end as a doubter. The label in the moment did not define him. His life became this living example and sacrifice of the gospel, and thousands of people came to know Jesus because of Thomas. And what's interesting about Thomas, that fearless Thomas that said, "Let us go that we may die with him," most of the disciples went from Israel and went west, kind of into Europe in the Mediterranean. Thomas went east. He went towards India. He went towards that was a little bit more unknown because he was no doubter. He knew that Jesus was his Lord and his God. You see, Thomas was more than a moment. And you are more than a moment. You are more than a moment because Jesus is full of grace and he is full of truth. And no single moment has the power to define you. Today I invite you to let go of that moment or that label or that mistake that might be defining you. To let Jesus, the one who is full of grace and full of truth, be the person who redefines who you are and makes you new, because the resurrection is real. And we can cross a line of faith and we can say, "My Lord and my God, you are who you say you are." As we close today, we're going to celebrate a moment of communion. We as the church participate in communion simply because Jesus told us to do so. That's why we do this. There was a moment where Jesus was with his disciples on the night before he was arrested and betrayed by a close friend. And he gathered with them for the Passover meal. And while they were eating, he took bread, and after giving thanks, he broke it and said, This is my body broken for you." And in the same manner, he took the cup and said, "This is my blood shed for you." It represents the new covenant, the new reality that I have created for you. Whenever you partake of this bread and partake of this cup, do so in remembrance of me. And the bread that we break and this cup that we bless reminds us of who Jesus is. And it reminds us of who we are in Jesus, because it redefines us. Because no one moment has the power, and no one label has the power. Jesus does. So in a moment, we're going to invite you to come forward and experience in tangible form what it means to see that grace and truth come to you today. So at this time, I would invite those who are helping serve to come forward. And as they do that, I'll give some instructions. We'll move this table over here, and this table will come up a little bit. If you require a gluten-free option for communion, we have some crackers over there. That will be appropriate for that. We practice communion by intinction. So we'll grab a piece of bread, and then you'll dip it into the cup. And I'm going to pray, and then we'll begin. And if you're wondering, what should I do in this moment, I just give the words of Jesus to you. "Peace be with you." He meets his disciples in that locked house and says, "Peace be with you. See the holes in my hands and see the scar in my side, and know that I was dead, but I rose from the grave, and that I am real, and I am full of grace, and I am full of truth." And today, in this moment, we can receive that grace and that truth. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your love, and we thank you that you come toward us, that there is no one moment or word or label that can define us, and it doesn't have the power because you do. You create reality and you redefine us. And I pray for us as we step into the celebration of communion that we can receive your grace and your truth in this moment. And we can know that the resurrection is real and that it has power to redefine and shape who we are. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.